Tonight on Arena, the 40-year-old version, Body of Water and The Other Lamb are the movies up for review. And Emily Harrigan tells the story of the Guinness family in her new novel. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we'll kick off with movies, as we always do on a Thursday evening. Up for your consideration tonight, Netflix midlife crisis comedy, The 40-Year-Old Version, family drama, Body of Water, and The Other Lamb, which was shot here in Ireland. Joining me this evening, Donald Clark and Roe McDermott. And we'll start with The 40-Year-Old Version. Stars the writer-director Radha Blank playing a character called Radha Blank. So, Roe, what is the version of Radha Blank that we're getting in this film, certainly at the start of the story?
Yeah, so this is definitely a semi-autobiographical tale. So, of course, Radha Blank is using her own name. So for clarity, we might refer to the character as just Radha and the director as Radha Blank. But Radha Blank had some major success in her life. And in 2001, she had a lot of success with this off-Broadway production she had called Seed. She's written a bit for Empire. She's got a Havis. She was named a 30 under 30 star. But then in real life, Radha Blank's mother died, and she said that this really derailed her career. And in a way, the film takes a lot of these major plot points, that the character of Radha is also a playwright who was named a 30 under 30 star, but her mother died as well. And so she's been spending her time teaching drama in Harlem to a bunch of young students and kind of having a constant inner conflict of how to approach her work and how to stay true to her authentic self. She's deciding between going with the Black Theater Company to produce her work, but they won't pay her properly, or whether she should allow kind of the liberal colonialism of white producers and directors dictate the work that she is doing and allow and turn her work into kind of caricatures of her community. And so this constant inner conflict is throughout the film, along with her sense of grief and thinking about what her artist mother would have done in the same situation. So it's really a film about artistry and identity. And like a lot of films that are also set around New York, like Frances Ha, Manhattan, She's Gotta Have It, it's about artistry, it's about identity and community, and it's also shot in black and white. So New York and Harlem in particular really become a character in this film.
Donald, she's grappling both the character and the writer here and director, I guess, with what it means to be a female black playwright in a New York theatre scene that certainly considers itself very woke. She's poking fun at that, but she's doing more than just poking fun at it.
Well, she is. I mean, I think the film is rather brilliant in the way that the liberal, still largely white New York artistic establishment reframes the black experience in its own uninformed terms. I mean, all these people clearly like to think of themselves as being very connected to social justice and all these sorts of things, but get it wrong constantly. I mean, it's funny, when I was one of the central characters in the picture is this gatekeeper, I think the phrase would be, called Whitman, which is rather kind of what his surname is, Whitman, which is wonderfully pompous way of identifying him. And there's a scene where he says at some point, talking about the play that she's about to write, the work that she's about to do, that it rang a little inauthentic. And he asked himself, did a black person really write this? And I kind of thought, well, maybe does this ring inauthentic? Would somebody really say that? But then, of course, like, this is part of the point that she's making. Who the hell am I to say? She's actually in this world and clearly has experienced these experiences, and clearly that's still going on. I think all those things happen, but it's worth stressing that all these conversations are had about the problems of representation for African Americans, even in environments that are supposed to be kind of well disposed towards them, like Bohemian New York. Yeah. All those conversations are had. The conversations are had about the expectations you have for yourself and how you might live them. But it never stops being a comedy. It's a very important point to make about it, lest we make it sound too pompous, and self-important. Yeah. I like him. Rose Point is very good about strange things. Like, what is it with American independent filmmakers and black and white and Manhattan? That is it that the city is so still so attached to its identity in the 1940s and 1950s, and they always go back to it. And she's got to have it, this example, obviously, of that, Manhattan's example of that. It's fascinating, but it there's definitely something about that. It definitely does heighten the sense of that extraordinary city, putting it in monochrome.
Yeah, let's have a listen to a clip from the 40-year-old version. And she has to earn some money, does Rada Blank, so she's giving workshops to high school students for her sins. Very difficult work, I would have thought. And in this clip, she's been challenged by them about her credentials.
Okay, that's fine. Make jokes. Just remember, it's your play. It'll be whatever you put into it. If you put in nothing, it'll be nothing.
Like your career?
Ooh. Ouch. Really, Elaine?
I Googled you. Last time you did anything was, what, 2010?
Oh, 2012? And then producing her because white people scared of the truth. Right, Miss B?
Rosa, thank you, but it's not about me.
Right, Brosa? Stop kissing her ass.
Damn, Elaine. Why you gotta be so negative?
I'm saying, how somebody who ain't had no real hit gonna tell me how to write a fucking play? She ain't no Tyler Perry.
I actually appreciate that, thank you.
And that's why she's teaching after school, coming late every day when nobody wants to be here.
I told you. There were 20 invalids on my bus today, okay? But you know what? Elaine, this isn't Dangerous Minds. You can leave whenever you want. And by the way, I actually have a production coming up. Thank you. I'm just saying.
Workshop production? It ain't even regional theater, please.
Well, a class of students like that, what kind of help do you, what kind of challenges do you need? And they know how to express themselves, it has to be said as well. Ro McDermott, when we listened to that clip, it really struck me at the very beginning there, one of the characters challenges her, and there's a big long pause, she says ouch, and then she says the character's name. We could have just had her saying the character's name, particularly in the early part of this film. It's slow to get going, it spends a long time setting things up.
Yeah, but I actually think I preferred the first half to the second half, to be honest, because I think Rada Blank, her comedy chops are just so brilliant. And the first half, when we're meeting this character and we're meeting this world, her comedy is just so hilariously observational. And even in that clip, you heard references to Tyler Perry, who is a black director and writer who's been criticized for particularly his portrayal of black women, that he has one archetype and it's usually that a work-obsessed woman needs to be saved by the romance of a good man, and these ideas that there's one black story that's been told over and over again from mainstream audiences, which is exactly what this film is railing against. The film is more focused on white perspectives, but that idea, she says, like, oh, I appreciate that I'm not Tyler Perry, thank you. And even then the reference to Dangerous Minds, the idea that we have so many films where it's about young black students and then a white figure comes in and saves them. So you see that in Dangerous Minds and even more modern films like Hidden Figures, where you have the stories of incredible black women, but of course they have to bring in like Kevin Costner to save the day.
Of course.
So I think her comedy is so brilliant, but she's also awkward and funny, and she makes mistakes. And but then they also introduce this relationship. Elaine, ironically, the student who's calling her out in the clip, she raps at the start of one of her classes, and this kind of inspires Rada, the character, to go back to what motivated her in high school, which was rapping and rhyming. And so we see her reaching out to this Brownsville DJ named Dee, and she starts rapping, and her raps are far more authentic than the work that she's been allowed to produce. So she records tracks called Poverty Porn, and she's brilliantly skewering all of the cliches that white keepers, especially those who think of themselves as woke, expect to see in the art they're enabling. So
now,
I think I really like it. I think the first half is really strong and really, really consistently funny in multiple ways.
As Donald points out, she manages to keep the comedy going in the midst of all that, particularly in the rap sections where she's funny doing the rap, but she's also making very serious points in, for example, around the idea of poverty porn and very serious topics there. But Donald, a lot of that means then that the film itself hinges on the performance of the writer and director and leading actor, Rada Blank herself. How does she acquit herself?
Oh, she's the greatest asset the film has is her, no question about that. I mean, it's beautifully shot and her own screenplay, loosely thrown together though it is excellent. But I mean, she herself is what makes it. I mean, she's an extraordinary presence. And also she has done that thing, which is you get more often in television situation comedy, which is that notion of producing a version of yourself that moves through a world very similar to your own, but is tweaked in certain ways to make it funnier and make it more digestible for the viewer. I mean, Larry Sanders and, you know, Jerry Seinfeld are two obvious examples from television. Does that. I also want to make a point out about just about being happy to be able to see this on this platform. I think it's worth making that point. This is not an original Netflix production. They picked it up at Sundance. But it's exactly the sort of thing that they should be doing. I mean, they're backing up enormous trucks of money to David Fincher and Martin Scorsese, which is fine. I mean, you know, these people deserve to have money. They've put in the work. But, you know, backing up a few more smaller vanfuls of money towards people like Rada Blank would be no bad thing.
Yeah, okay. And I love, by the way, her MC title, which is Radimus Prime. Great fun with that. Okay, stars from you then. First of all, Donald, for the 40-year-old version?
Oh, 4, comfortably.
4 comfortably. Ro, what are you saying?
Yeah, I think 4 as well. I really enjoyed it. I do think the second half drags on a little bit too long. I think 15 minutes could have been easily trimmed, but it's really fun. It's really smart. And I think Rada Blank is just such a joy to watch. And I hope we see so much more of her.
Yeah, she is very funny. Okay, let us move on then to film number 2. Filmed in Ireland, in fact, The Other Lamb, a disturbing drama from Polish director Małgorzata Szumowska, focusing on a cult led by a messianic figure known as Shepherd. He leads a band of women on some sort of a quest. I'll start with you on this one, Donald. Do we know where we are in time and in place? And is that important?
Well, ultimately we do, because I don't want to give anything away. It's actually not any kind of spoiler, but just as it happens, she delays the revelation as to where we are and to an extent when we are until the very end, when a character appears, which clarifies that somewhat. But that doesn't really add anything to our understanding or lack of understanding of the story. It is clearly set in clearly is not the right word. It is set in a kind of timeless nowhere that could be Tasmania, that could be, you know, the Pacific Northwest of the United States. It actually is set in it's shot in Wicklow, but it doesn't actually look very much like Wicklow. I mean, it's very nice. The cinematography is beautiful, but it's shot during the colder months, so it doesn't have that kind of lush greenness that you expect from the Garden of Ireland. So I think that's very much kind of there appears to be a conscious decision there to put us in a place to disorient us by putting us in an environment that seems out of time and out of place. It's a very interesting thing, is that I mean, I really enjoyed this film. I think it's imprecision is part of the pleasure. The fact that it puts you into kind of this limbo that I found quite satisfying for a film about such a disturbing subject, and the disturbing subject that cinema is enormously keen on. I mean, it's funny, you look at The Wicker Man, Holy Smoke, the King Campion film, The Master, Martha Marcy May Merlane, Midsummer recently. The notion of the cult is something that really appeals to filmmakers, which I guess something to do with the fact that there is the need to address the human animal's natural need to follow, but also with the fact that these are things that never go away, that we're having these obsessive kind of followings, more so now than ever, politically. You see this with sort of irrational kind of beliefs and people marching on the streets to support irrational beliefs. You see it on the internet, been seeing it forever. It never quite goes away. And I like the fact that they structure the cult loosely. It is, we assume, because of certain cultural references, that it has a Christian leaning or reference, because the word shepherd is used and because he looks vaguely Christ-like. But in fact, it's really all about patriarchal dominance. The shepherd, who's a guy who leads these figures, seems to have no real ideology to speak of. He seems to be just in it for himself and for his own perverted desires.
Yeah, well, let's listen to a clip that gives us a sense of exactly who and what the shepherd is. Michael Huisman, is that how I say his name? He addresses his group of women, and that's how he would describe them as well. At this point, they're all dressed in white, and he has a sacrificial lamb in front of him on this makeshift altar, and you'll hear him putting his hands into the blood towards the end of the clip.
My wives, you all came to me broken, searching, hurt by a cruel world that is more filled with pain every day. I took every one of you in. I protected you. I sacrificed my life for you. I gave you shelter. I gave you daughters and sisterhood and life. Let us pray and reflect on our blessings.
And so he goes around the group of women then, smearing them with the blood from the sacrificial lamb that's on the table in front of Mikhail Huseman there as the shepherd in The Other Lamb, the second of our films on this Thursday evening. He's a great guy there, Ro, it has to be said. He took them in. He protected them. He sacrificed himself for them. Isn't he great to be looking after them so well?
So lovely. Such a charmer. Yeah, I think even from that film, you can get a sense that the film is so atmospheric and there's such a sense of everything being so ominous and eerie. And it is photographed so beautifully. And also, but also there's such macabre visions in it, because basically the story starts to develop as Sela, played by Rafi Cassidy, is kind of this auburn-haired beauty and one of his favorite daughters. He refers to the women as wives and daughters, which essentially is just an age marker. And Sela is portrayed as one of the most pure followers of him and never questions him. But she's also getting older and approaching puberty. And this is shown to be a problem within this cult, in that when women menstruate, they're banished essentially for, they're declared to be impure. There are references to Eve's sin. And as she, her coming of age is starting, she starts having increasingly disturbing visions that are, again, just photographed so beautifully with this nightmarish quality. She starts seeing mauled lambs. She starts seeing images of women with red stripes on their neck. And it's this idea that she is coming of age and also coming out of the innocence that the cult demands and that she's starting to question. And one plot point sees the cult have to move and they have to find a new location. And it's really this trip, this arduous journey on foot, where Sela starts really questioning the shepherd, and this is where the kind of intrigue starts. Yeah, and the power comes from the setting hugely, because it's so claustrophobic and ominous and eerie that you get the atmosphere, which has to be there because the psychology for me was slightly lacking.
Yeah, because a kind of relationship begins to build between the Sela character, as you say, played by Rafi Cassidy, and a character called Sarah by Denise Goff, but it kind of starts to go somewhere and doesn't really go somewhere. But let's listen to a clip which features the both of them, actually. Sela is shielding under a canopy and speaking to what has to be said, a very worn down looking character called Sarah, played by Denise Goff.
What happened to you? He said it was punishment for my vanity. He said the same when he cut my hair. Now he calls me a broken thing. I don't believe you. You look so much like your mother when you say that.
Rafi Cassidy and Denise Goff there in a scene from The Other Lamb. The accents are very clearly American, we can hear in the midst of that clip as well. That's been played, Donald. But the other thing that struck me was the way the women are dressed. There are very vivid blue dresses, very vivid red dresses, and each one a code as to who they are. There are definitely shades of The Handmaid's Tale in here.
Yes, well, I would say that's almost certainly accidental. I think it's a specific reference. And what struck me about that is that it kind of highlights the stylized nature of the visuals, in that quite clearly these people were living in circumstances in which he is the Manson cult. that Manson cult who ended up.
I tell you, as we're losing you slightly there, Donald, we might try reconnecting. And in the meantime, I'll talk to Ro. I think Donald's bringing up a point there about the Manson cult. And it did strike me, to what extent are we dealing with some kind of archetypal reference or a present representation of a cult here? Or are we dealing with something that might be recognisable as more recent versions, all too real versions of cult?
Yeah, I think that's the problem I had with the film, because I think there's so many resonance here of the kind of fringe beliefs and belief systems that people turn to when they're feeling vulnerable or when they're feeling disenfranchised. And there's so much material there that is possible to get into. And I don't think the film really does. And I think a major problem I had with it is that Shepherd isn't a particularly convincing leader for me. He didn't particularly project the kind of magnetism that demonstrates why so many of his followers would forswear kind of normal life and self-determination to serve his kind of very puerile alpha male fantasies. And the cruelty beneath his kind of surface charisma, it doesn't come out in very surprising or complex ways. And the belief system is very vague and very opaque. And it seems so obviously self-serving for him and so oppressive towards the women that for me, it kind of didn't hit the complexity of psychological realism, but then also was slightly more realistic to be a fable. And for me, that just felt like a lack of context and a lack of development. And I think the women in their interactions with each other all seem kind of more interesting and strong. And so it's not entirely convincing that particularly when things get abusive, that they would surrender so much power. So I think there was a need for more complexity there and more development.
I'll let you do a final summation then of what you felt about it. Donald, you're back with us now, and give us your stars, if you would.
I am. Well, I'm kind of divided in the point that Roe makes. It's absolutely true that they make no great effort to sell the charisma of the shepherd, and therefore to explain to us why these women might have been drawn into his trap. But then again, I think it's quite common for the charisma of these leaders to be obscure to anybody who's not been sucked in by them. I think that, I mean, someone like Jim Jones was, you know, no sort of charmer. I felt that was not an entirely unwise decision to give us a sort of blank archetype of the cult leader and of how cults function, and then allow us to impose any kind of complications ourselves onto that archetype. So I wasn't too concerned about that, but it is true, it does make the film lack a certain amount of colour.
Right.
That's certainly true.
Stars from you, Donald.
Four stars. I would still give it four stars. I thought it was a very, very convincing piece of work.
All right, and Ro?
I'm going to give it three for me. I think it looks beautiful. I think it's very interesting. But in the end, I feel like the director and screenwriter aren't saying much more than blind submission to a patriarch is bad news for everybody, which is true, but so obvious that I think a bit more detail and nuance wouldn't go amiss.
All right, so four and three respectively then for our second film, The Other Lamb. Let's move on to final film this evening, Body of Water, directed by Lucy Bryden. British movie focusing on a woman with an eating disorder who emerges from a treatment centre and attempts to reconnect with her mother and teenage daughter. Ro, I think one of the interesting points here, I mean, films about anorexia often focus on young girls or teenagers. This is a different focus in terms of the illness.
Yeah, and I think it's a really important choice, actually, because I think here it shows that anorexia has laid waste to the life and relationships of an adult woman. And I think so often stories about eating disorders, again, like you said, they focus on teenage girls and they also focus on a kind of quick and fairly easy recovery. And this film isn't afraid to kind of linger in the discomfort of it and linger in the really horrible and difficult realities of anorexia that can plague people and how it affects it. And how it affects kind of physically, emotionally and mentally both the sufferers and the people around them. So it focuses here on Stephanie, played by Shan Brooke, and she has been in and out of treatment. She herself is the mother of a teenage girl called Pearl, who her own mother is now looking after. And she's coming out of treatment yet again for her mother's wedding. And it's about basically the routine of this. Like, we see her meeting her mother, and her mother is going through a very familiar routine now of criticism and care. And as Stephanie is leaving the treatment center, she almost looks at it longingly, because I think there's such an awareness that the real hard work of surviving in the world outside of the treatment center is only just beginning, and she's aware of this routine. So I think it's a really brave choice, and I think it opens up dynamics that we don't often see in films about eating disorder with the family, with daughters, with mothers. So it really becomes a generational story.
Another aspect of it obviously is the visual, and this is, I thought, treated quite cleverly and with a little bit of new quite a bit of nuance, in fact, it has to be said. And it's exemplified in this scene that we hear quite close to the beginning of the film, actually. Stephanie, played by Shan Brook, she's returned home after this 7 months in the treatment centre for anorexia. Her nurse, a man called Sean, played by Nick Blood, is visiting her for the first time. Now, he's been checking her weight at this point. She's just stepped off the scales and he notices some photographs on the table.
Good. All right. Who's that?
Oh, it's just old work.
So you'll go back to it, the photography?
I don't know.
I've never met anyone who does anything like that. Not around here, anyway.
Not much use when you can't even go to the supermarket without having a panic attack. Well, what about you? I never asked you how you got into this.
Oh, I couldn't take the abuse from the pissheads on a Friday night anymore, so I retrained. Yeah, I thought I told you. Mm. I'm just covering Carrie's maternity leave, so she'll be back in a couple of months, and that'll be me. Back to just doing these sort of community visits with patients.
Patient. It's a funny word, isn't it? Patiently waiting not to be sick.
Shan Brook there as Stephanie, Nick Blood as Sean in a scene from Body of Water. That scene, Donald Clark, gives us a real sense of it's not in a hurry to rush through scenes, this film. It takes its time to let the characters establish themselves, to let the atmospheres establish themselves and the dynamics between the characters establish themselves.
Yes, I'm not entirely sure that I felt the characters leapt out at me in a way that I would want. I mean, it is a terrifically sincere and very responsible case study, I thought. I mean, I'm not suggesting that it's literally based on a case study, but it seems to me very clear that it's been very well researched and that elements of this condition and how this condition manifests itself have been worked in very assiduously and very responsibly into the script. I learned a lot, I would certainly say that. I mean, there's a very interesting bit early on in the group session when the mentor of the session is comforting an attendee who's been, you know, abused by someone close to them, and he says they're talking to the illness, not you. And that seemed to me a very convincing argument about one of the things people who emerge from facilities like this or are just dealing with it, even not connected to a facility, have to confront, is that people don't look at them, they only see the illness, the condition that's behind them. It's also very good on the way in which people make insensitive remarks without really thinking about it, just the slightest remark. There's a scene when she's trying on a dress for this wedding that's coming up and a relative says it would work better on a girl with curves, and you sort of think, does she know where we are with this? I mean, does she know where that's all good? But I'm gonna say I didn't really feel that these people had much lives outside the position that they're currently in. All very good actors. It's great to see Amanda Burton back in film.
She plays the mother. Stephanie's mother. Yeah.
But to me, you know, I sort of kept feeling what one of the great naturalistic directors would do with this material and would actually make the characters live. For me, the characters didn't live. For me, outside that notion of it explaining, as I say, very responsibly and very carefully, yeah, the dynamics of this illness, it for me didn't really live.
Ro, that's part of what Donald is talking about there, I think, is there are times when we're brought into therapy sessions with other people who have eating disorders and they're speaking in these therapy sessions. Again, very real, but was there an aspect in this, you know, when we were talking earlier on about the 40-year-old version, we said they managed to keep a lightness of touch here. Was there a lightness of touch missing in this film?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's okay tonally. Like, given the subject matter, I think that's okay. And I think one plot point that's really interesting is showing how insular someone with anorexia becomes because the disorder takes over their entire life. And we see one plot point sees Stephanie protect her eating disorder really over the safety of others. And I think that was a very powerful point to make because it's devastating. It just shows how vulnerable she is, how open to being coerced by both her eating disorder and those around her. But I think a problem that Body of Water has is that Bryden occasionally opts for kind of extreme and unearned plot developments because the characters aren't really fully developed, and sometimes they can feel shallow and feel like they're striving to make a point rather than feel authentic, which I think undermines slightly the brilliantly authentic scenes we do get in the treatment facilities. So I think sometimes it can be a little bit over the top in how the characters move through this world because we don't get a sense of their real inner lives. And I think, to be honest, a major difficulty I have with the film is that it's likely to attract an audience who have some relationship with eating disorders. It's likely to attract an audience that is mainly comprised of women, audience figures for films with these themes often do. And I think that's really important for people to see their experiences represented on screen. But I also think that some of the film itself, particularly the shots of Stephanie's body and references to kind of enabling websites that a lot of people with eating disorders go on, could be quite triggering. So I think it's something to, I think it's done well in a lot of ways. I think the plot developments take some missteps and the characterization takes some missteps. And I think it's just one that people should be mindful going into in terms of how it's going to affect them.
All right. Well, how does that translate, Ro, then, in terms of star rating for you, first of all?
I'm going to give it a 3. I think there's some really brilliant things. I think Shan Brook is beautiful in this, and I think it does some really interesting things. And I think some of the characterization is lacking slightly and become slightly overwrought.
All right. And Donald?
Yeah, I mean, I think right to what Ro was saying, I felt there's like an appalling scene in the end when someone does something really dreadful. And that felt kind of unearned. You know, I sort of felt you have to try and talk me through why this person would do something so blatantly awful. And the ending, I think, is tricky. Right. I would say than that. So I would say no more than that. I thought it was a very worthwhile piece of work, but I wouldn't go beyond 3.
All right. That's Donald Clark and Ro McDermott speaking to us about our films this evening. The final one we spoke about there, Body of Water, and indeed the second film, The Other Lamb, available on video on demand, while the 40-year-old version, the first film that we spoke about this evening, is available on Netflix. This week, Netflix announced that they will be streaming the entire series of Dawson's Creek, the American teen drama that launched the careers of Katie Holmes and Michelle Williams, or Joey and Jen, as you probably know them as. Earlier this month, Beverly Hills 90210 marked its 30th anniversary, and who can forget My So-Called Life with Claire Danes, Jared Leto, and their on-again, off-again relationship as Angela and Jordan. Joining me now, Jen Gannon, to talk about the allure and the evolution of the teen drama over the years, how they started as escapist fantasies, but have gone on to become hard-hitting and indeed gritty, I think it is safe to say. Just want to check, do I have you? Yes. No, we. Yes. Why don't we remind ourselves how Beverly Hills used to start, please? The theme music. Oh, yes. And there we are, right back in Beverly Hills 90210. And even the music kind of sets up for us, Jen, just the type of escapism that was involved here. These were very rich teenagers living a very glamorous lifestyle that surely a few teens in the early 90s at any rate could relate to, I would have thought.
We had no idea what had hit us. I remember seeing it in my bedroom. We got a little TV in me and my sister's bedroom. We're very lucky. And we got to experience that on our Saturday evening. And I think it blew our minds as an Irish audience. Like, it was so foreign to our way of life back then. Like, the schools were these alien, glamorous realm where you didn't have to wear a uniform, the classes were mixed, everyone had a car, everyone had their own credit card for some reason, and they were all more concerned about who they were bringing to prom than, you know, worrying about doing honours maths next year or whatever. And they just had this extravagant lifestyle, and all we were used to was seeing Grange Hill. And Grange Hill to me at that time was like, you know, a documentary, a boring documentary. It was all leaky radiators and damp classrooms, and this was completely opposite to this. It was a million miles away from it. It was so much fun. Like, the kids in 90210, they were just reckless and wild. Yeah. And their behaviour was something out of like a Jackie Jackie Collins novel, nothing that we had seen before. Like, it was not the cartoon antics of Saved by the Bell or anything. And I remember the hype surrounding it before it actually came to air, and they were saying it was going to be risque, it was sexy, it was taboo, and it certainly wasn't a TV show that was for family viewing. It was marketed for teenagers, and it was about teenagers, and that's what really hooked people in. It was the first time there was like this demarcation between adult TV and children's TV. It was teenagers TV for the first time.
All right, but even within those teenagers, there could still be some tutting going on from some of the characters. Let's listen to a clip. Now, this is the normally the good guy, Brandon, played by Jason Priestley, never did anything wrong until this scene at any rate. He takes drugs with his girlfriend, Emily, played by Christine Louise McCarthy. Now, his sister, Brenda, played by Shannon Doherty, and her boyfriend, Dylan, played by Luke Perry, do not approve.
Brandon, are you on something, man?
What?
Yeah, the hood of my car, same as you.
Where did you get that little scar on your eyebrows? It's so cute. I don't believe this.
Oh, hey, Brandon, relax. I feel great. I feel stoned, man. Well, you're the expert. I mean that in a good way, you know? You handle your alcohol thing real good.
Look, shut up, man.
So negative, really, man.
Vibes, you guys. Ouch.
I feel really bad for you. Thanks for your sympathy, Emily. Look, why don't you guys just give me the car keys? I'm not going to let you drive yourselves home.
No, Bren, I can't do that because, number one, I'm not ready to leave yet. And number two, no offense, but I've seen you drive and it's not a pretty sight.
Give them, here, man, $40. Jones, get in a cab.
All right, cool.
Cabbage. Dylan, we can't just leave them. I mean, what if he gets in trouble? What if he gets hurt?
Brenda.
What if he hurts himself?
You don't get it, do you? He doesn't care. Not right now. Look at him. He's so high. He's king of the mountain. He's got a girl. Everything's fine. Until tomorrow when he wakes up feeling like hell and we'll see what an ass he made of himself.
And there we go. Jason Priestley, Christine Louise McCarthy, Shannon Doherty and Luke Perry in a scene from Beverly Hills. Jen Gannon looking at the evolution of the teen drama with us this evening. To what extent is that the way they handled serious topics? You know, did they really get in there? There's a teen pregnancy was in there at one stage, you know, a drink driving obviously within all of that aspect that we had there as well. Did it get into any kind of nitty gritty look at these issues, or did it just, you know, skate along the surface?
It did and it didn't. Because it was the first of its kind, it really broke the mould, you know, and it still, it gave us those tropes that still play out today. Like you said, there was like, you know, storylines about eating disorders, drug taking, binge drinking, teen pregnancy, and references to alcoholic parents. And, you know, kids were getting nose jobs like they were changing their hair colour. And that was the allure of it. But it had morals. And everything always ended up turning out okay for the gang in the end. They might get, you know, given out to by their parents a bit, but there was nothing too stressful for them. It was never overtly moralistic in its tone, though. And I think that was a conscious decision for Darren Star, who was the showrunner of the Beverly Hills at the time. And he was only 27. And we know him now from going on to doing Sex and the City and Melrose Place and even Emily in Paris, the show for Netflix, the recent one. And I think characters made mistakes, but no one ever paid too dearly for them. Like, it wasn't big on guilt. And I think something that was huge was when Brenda and Dylan, they slept together, and it wasn't, there wasn't this huge consequences for them. It wasn't shameful. And I remember, you know, watching that in Dublin, like in my little room, just thinking that was mind blowing, really. And it just changed people's way of thinking. And I think it had a very, at that time, it was MTV all the time. And I think the way the show was cleverly edited and the way it used music, there were songs from REM and the Cramps and Chris Isaacs, they were all used within the soundtrack to great effect, and the editing was done like a pop video. That made it so different from your mum and dad's TV. It was so original.
The theme tune for Beverly Hills sets up a kind of a sheeny Beverly Hills lifestyle. The theme tune for Dawson's Creek, I think a little bit more gentle. Let's have a listen. There we go. we go. I Don't Want to Wait from Paula Cole, the theme tune to Dawson's Creek. A lot gentler, as I said, really Jen Gannon than Beverly Hills 90210. These were more, were they more thoughtful, more self-aware characters?
100%. I mean, it was a world away from Beverly Hills 90210 was quite snarky and trashy, but this was very much, people used to say about Dawson's Creek that the teenagers themselves were way too articulate. They were very verbose and they were a world away from the likes and you knows that inflected the 90210 script. And Kevin Williamson, who created Dawson's Creek, who went on to do the Scream franchise, he wanted the characters to be quite knowing and self-aware. But it kind of, Dawson's Creek came out at a time of the mid-90s or the late 90s, where you had that time for serious reflective teen dramas like Felicity and, like you were saying, My So-Called Life with Claire Danes and Jared Leto. And they were critically acclaimed, if they, you know, if they didn't really find a big audience. So Dawson's Creek was kind of like the populist version of something like My So-Called Life, where your teen protagonists were very tortured and clever and multifaceted. And we all know that Dawson is an emotional hero. I mean, anybody who's ever opened Twitter can see that gif of James Van Der Beek crinkling his face up and crying when he's breaking up with Joey. So it was a different, completely different pace to Beverly Hills, and much slowed down. Even it's kind of more even bucolic. And I know that it did start with Pacey Witter, who was played by Joshua Jackson. He was the bad boy. He was having an affair with his teacher in the first season. But other than that, it was a much slower pace, and it was much more considered and philosophical than you would have been used to before.
Moving on then to the OC, I suppose there were a few laughs in here for sure, but it was the bringing of the parents into the storylines, I think, that was notable here.
Very different, yeah. The OC kind of, I think with the OC, Josh Schwartz, he had a lot to look back on. He had a decade of other teen dramas to pick and choose from, so it was self-referential, and it did manage to, you know, reference and ape and dismantle all the other teen dramas that came with it. And I think it successfully integrated the parents into the storylines, because they weren't seen as these old fuddy-duddies. They were younger and hipper, and they had their own storylines that kind of worked well with the teens themselves. And I think that changed a lot for the teen drama.
I wanted to finish up by talking about Euphoria. Let's listen to a clip. First of all, the character here is Rue, played by Zendaya, and even the theme, even what's been talked about here, is more serious than anything we've spoken about up to now.
The other thing about depression is it kind of collapses time.
Rue, are you listening?
Suddenly, you find your whole days blending together to create one endless and suffocating loop. So you find yourself trying to remember the things that made you happy.
Can we get closer?
But slowly, your brain begins to erase every memory that ever brought you joy. And eventually, all you can think about is how life has always been this way. And will only continue to be this way.
There we have Euphoria, clip from the present day series. And Jen Gannon, just to briefly to finish up with, that is darker than anything we've spoken about. We're in a whole different world. Briefly and finally, Jen?
Yeah, I mean, it's HBO doing a teen drama, so as you can imagine, it does everything from talking about rehab to prescription drug addiction to gender identity and acceptance. It's a new world, and it's a harsher world for teens out there today, and I think that's what Euphoria does reflect. If still being tinged with a bit of fantasy, I don't think anybody needs to pop upstairs and worry about all their kids now dabbling in prescription drugs, but it still does reflect the world that is surrounding teens at the moment, I think.
Well, that's great. Thanks for bringing us through that potted history there of the teen drama. That's Jen Gannon. And if you feel like a trip down memory lane and escape from reality, Dawson's Creek will be on Netflix from November the 1st. Emily Hurricane's latest novel, The Glorious Guinness Girls, tells the story of three sisters, Aileen, Maureen and Una Guinness, from their idyllic childhood in their stately home in Ireland while the War of Independence was raging outside, to the exuberance and decadence of London's high society, where debutantes mix with the bright young things of post-war England. And Emily Hurricane joins me now on the line. I had a couple of words written down to describe them, and I was wary about even using them. Brilliant, spoilt and flighty, the Guinness sisters, Emily.
I think that's fair enough.
Well, Maureen, Aileen and Una, they aren't all the same person. How different are they? We're in kind of the 1918 through until 1930 is where we are with the novel.
Exactly. Yes. So at the end of the novel, they are really just, I mean, Una, who is the youngest, is not even 21. She's just married and she's 19. How different are they? They're really quite different. So Eileen, who is the eldest, Maureen is the middle, and Una is the youngest. All of them very beautiful. They were the glorious Guinness girls. They were hugely written about in gossip columns throughout the 1920s because they were incredibly rich. And they were also very beautiful. And they loved parties. They loved going to parties and being written about. But within that, they were... Eileen always strikes me as the most aloof of the three. She was very elegant. She was extremely interested in couture clothes. She was also a reasonably silent person. You know, she was good fun, but she wasn't as madcap as Maureen, the middle one, who, for me, is the most fascinating of the three of them, particularly at that stage in their lives. Maureen did actually go on to become rather monstrous. In her later life, Maureen was the model for the caricature of Dame Edna Average that Barry Humphreys created. So, I mean, that gives you some idea of the person she turned into. Yeah. She was famous for being a snob. She was famous for her obsession with the Queen Mother. She was famous for being rude and putting people down. But in her younger years, she was also, by the way, according to people who knew her, even when she was monstrous, she was very compelling, magnetic person with an enormous personality. So as a young person, before she became monstrous, I am so interested in her and her kind of energy and her spirit, which were both huge. And then Una, the youngest, the sweetest, she believed that she was her father's favorite, and she may well have been. Some people believed her to be the prettiest, but I think that's kind of a moot point. Very maternal person, very gentle, very sweet, very warm, quite shy, could be quite quiet. And then apparently this quite devastating wit when she did decide to speak.
You give us a real sense there of these very real people, very different personalities, like any set of siblings. They're not going to be exactly the same. They may have looked alike, but they aren't in personality exactly the same. But the person who brings us through the novel, Emily, is a character called Felicity. Fictional.
Yeah.
Into the midst of an historical novel, and we have the War of Independence as a backdrop, why did you want or why did you need this fictional narrator, Felicity Burke?
So I created Felicity because, as you say, this is a novel. It's a work of historical fiction. So while the skeleton of the novel, the events that happen, are based on the truth of the girls' lives and the period that they lived through, this amazing period of the 20th century, and in fact, those girls spanned the entire 20th century. They were born at the beginning. Eileen was born in 1904. She died in 1999. So they lived through all of the events, the War of Independence, the Civil War, the Roaring Twenties, the Second World War, into the 40s, 50s, 60s and beyond. And so all of this is true. All the circumstances and the detail and the dates of their lives are true. But I needed somebody who was able to look at the lives of these three girls from an outsider perspective. I needed somebody who would be able to see the insane privilege, the incredible wealth, the absurd way that they lived, because they can't see it. They're too much in their own lives. None of us see our own lives, clearly. You know, we just live them. So I wanted somebody who does not come from that kind of wealth at all to be able to come in.
Yes.
Fliss joins the novel when she's 11. So she grows up with the girls. She watches them grow up, because they're all about the same age as her. She watches them grow up and fall in love and all the things that happen to them. And she's able to see these things in a way that they aren't and make comparisons, which I think is vital.
And the other thing that Felicity has is an older brother called Huey, who kind of easygoing guy in at one level. But then there's the stable hand working on in the place as well, called Thomas Dolan, who's very political. And we're talking about Ireland, 1918. So we're just post the Easter Rising, a couple of years past that. We're into the War of Independence and we're into subsequently the Civil War. That political backdrop must have been of huge interest to you. And Felicity and her family and Thomas Dolan allow you to open that up.
Exactly, because the Guinnesses lived through these things, but they weren't really involved in them. I mean, they suffered from what, you know, Elizabeth Bowen describing the Anglo-Irish. She said it's feeling English in Ireland, feeling Irish in England, belonging nobody, nowhere rather. And certainly for the Guinnesses, they slightly floated above all of these historical events. So there is a bit in the book which is taken from a true account of the three of them in 1922, when they're in their early teens, standing and watching the burning of the forecourts in June. So the forecourts is going up in flames because the anti-treaty forces have occupied it and the treaty forces are burning them out, basically. And they were able to see that from their house in Castleknock, Glenmaroon. But they only stood and watched. They didn't participate. Mm. And I wanted somebody in the novel who was more involved, who, you know, was more Irish than they were, who felt the fight in a personal way that they definitely wouldn't have. And that, for me, was Huey.
And indeed, Thomas Dolan is an important part yeah. of that as well. And that's the kind of the first half of the novel. The second half of the novel, we find ourselves in London, the London of the Roaring Twenties and debutante society and the bright young things. That was a very interesting yes. place to write. Very different from Dublin, I would have thought.
Well, very different. So, in fact, I mean, in the real life account, which is also how I tell it in the novel, Ernest Guinness, who's the father of the girls, he decided that it was getting too dangerous in Ireland. So in very early 1920s, he took them on a round-the-world yacht cruise to get away from Ireland. They went to Japan. They went all over the place. And then they pitched up in London in very early 1924, and they were launched into society. So they were launched into society at exactly the same moment that the bright young people, so, you know, these kind of party-loving creatures who we know from Evelyn Waugh and from the novels of Nancy Mitford, were beginning to break down the stuffy old barriers of the London season. And so the girls were presented as debutantes, and they did that very stuffy, staid court ball thing. And then they began to get kind of charmed into this much more dynamic, yeah. exciting, glamorous life of the bright young people, their cocktails, their treasure hunts, their, you know, insane fancy dress parties, their trips through London, their jazz and cocktails.
The other thing I wanted to ask you just before we finish up, Emily, is actually the atmosphere of Glenmaroon, the house in Castleknock itself. Now, towards the end of the novel, we come back there in 1972. People mm-hmm. can read the novel to find out why we're there in 1972. How alike is the Glenmaroon of today? Does it exist today? Is it like the Glenmaroon of the 1918s, 1920s?
So it does. No, I don't think so. Sadly, I have not seen it for myself. It does exist. After the Guinnesses, it became a care home. So a religious order took it over. And it was a care home for young women for, I think, 20 years, but I'm not 100% clear on that. And then at a certain stage, it was abandoned. It was left empty for a very long time. It was used as a film set, so I know people who've been in there. But then it was sold. And when I went looking for A, who bought it, and B, could I get a tour of it, I was not able to find an answer to either of those questions. I don't know who has it now, but it is still there. And maybe somebody will pop up now and offer me a chance to go and have a look, because I would love to.
Yeah, well, the atmosphere that you give us of the 20th century, early 20th century Glenmaroon is certainly very atmospheric indeed. And that is Emily Hurricane speaking to me there about her novel, The Glorious Guinness Girls. It is published by Hachette. And that is our lot for this Thursday evening here in Arena. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1.